Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James and with me this week is Anne-Marie, Emmett and Rory from the My Wall Street analyst teams. Today, we're talking about Netflix's big merchandising play, why Ford Motors is making a massive comeback, and we chat to Scott Lynn, CEO of Masterworks, who tells us how we can easily start investing in iconic pieces of art. So guys, I hope you've all had your lunch before this, because a headline just popped up on my screen before we started recording, and I'm going to read it as follows. A lab test commissioned by the New York Times failed to identify any tuna DNA in a series of Subway tuna sandwiches. Are any of you customers or regular customers of Subway? Or will you be after that?
I am. And actually, I always go for their tuna sandwich. Well, do you know what? It really raises questions about the accuracy of DNA testing, because those sandwiches are really nice.
It might come down to like one of those fights, you know, the way farmers are now protesting against using the word meat in meat alternatives. It might be now that you're not allowed to call it a tuna sandwich. Wasn't there a thing in here in Ireland recently where there was a court case that Subway weren't allowed to call their bread anymore because the sugar content was so high?
Yeah, it was classified as cake. That's right, exactly. So some tax break they were getting because it was bread failed to exist because it was reclassified as cake. So I'm having a non-tuna cake. I don't know what it is, yeah, I'm ordering.
A cake with some tuna on it. Remember, they were when they first came out of Subway, they were like the healthy alternative. Wasn't that part of their marketing campaign? There was some guy who lost a load of weight. Anne-Marie, you might be more close to this because I think it was more US-based marketing.
Yeah, there was a guy, his name is Jared Fogel. He's kind of disgraced now at this point. He's in jail. So
let's not get into that.
Yeah, so didn't go well.
Why? Oh, just Google it afterwards. Those boards.
Yeah, and they never disclosed about that guy for Subway. Was he sold his car to buy the Subway, which then meant he was walking like 5 miles a day to go to Subway. So I think that would probably help the weight loss, maybe more than the Subway sandwiches.
It sounds like he ripped off your Netflix story, Emmett. Sold his car to buy Subway.
That's right.
I heard something, and this may be totally untrue. We may be about to be sued, but I thought the reason they were so healthy was because all the meat was like turkey meat. And just like they just like flavored it as ham or salami.
Or tuna, it
seems. Or tuna, maybe, whatever it was. That was totally a rumor. I have no, evidence to back that up.
Yeah, let's
There's
move
so
on.
Much distrust on meat anyway. Like, I mean, honestly.
What other mad speculation comes from here?
Let's move on quickly before we get sued. So on to Netflix. And two big bits of news have come out from Netflix recently over the past few weeks. Firstly, the company has launched a new online store called Netflix.shop. And this is an effort to tap into the extremely lucrative world of merchandising. So although the current merchandising offer is still pretty limited in scope, we can surely expect things to come out related to famous Netflix shows like Stranger Things, Bridgerton, The Queen's Gambit. And if that wasn't enough, there was a major shakeup of the old guard in Hollywood this week when it was announced that Steven Spielberg had signed a deal with the streaming service. His production company Amblin will produce multiple feature films for Netflix over the next few years as part of the deal, although we got no detail on how much money was exchanged or how long the partnership will go ahead. Getting Spielberg on board for Netflix is really a massive development, considering that Spielberg allegedly pushed for Netflix movies to be excluded from the Oscars a few years ago, although he's since come around to the idea of streaming, apparently. First things first, let's talk about the merchandising. Emmett, how big of an opportunity is the idea of selling merchandise and things related to Netflix's intellectual property? How big of a deal is that for the company?
It's very hard to size. I was looking at this because really it's a function of the popularity of their shows. And obviously Netflix shows like Stranger Things will drive quite a lot of merch demand. But I suspect the bigger picture with Steven Spielberg on board now is that there will be movies as of yet to be unveiled that will have extremely popular merchandise. I just think it's too much coincidence for those two announcements to happen within days of each other.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you think of Spielberg, you think of some of history's most iconic films like Jaws, Indiana Jones, E.T. Do we think that these two developments are related? Are Netflix trying to get their hands on more long-tail IP in order to boost their content offering, but also to boost their merchandising? Do you think that might be a possibility, Emmett?
I think so. I mean, if you just look at the industry, like 10 years ago, who would have thought that Amazon would buy MGM Studios for whatever, $8, $9 billion. Mm. And then Disney explode their content library into what I think is now something like 100 million subscribing homes in just a year and a half, by the way. And now we have hell has actually frozen over with the possibility of the greatest or at least the most popular director of all time signing an exclusive contract with Netflix. So really what we're looking at here is a complete disruption to the movie industry in a very, very short space of time. So for them to grab Spielberg and to launch a merchandise store in tandem kind of makes sense, because the entire model is evolving very quickly in front of our eyes and is changing almost month on month at this stage.
Yeah. Rory, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, wasn't it, didn't George Lucas famously give up the rights to Star Wars as long as he could hold on to the toy rights?
Yeah.
And that was how he made his fortune in the movie business. But like, I think as Emmett said, it's going to be very dependent on the type of IP that's out there, because some drives merchandise sales and some doesn't. You know, I'm not entirely sure how many people would want a little Gillian Anderson playing Margaret Thatcher doll. But I mean, I would, but.
Who wouldn't? It's like a baby Yoda, but it's British politics.
I think like some things like BoJack Horseman, for example, could be very popular in the merchandise side. But yeah, like I said, a lot of the shows Netflix have is probably just not going to be merchandise friendly.
Yeah, when you think about it, like there's the likes of Stranger Things and things, but I suppose they need to beef out their content even still to kind of address more merchandising opportunities. But when you look at Disney, for example, in 2019, the last full year before the pandemic, Disney recorded $9 billion in product revenues, which includes the sale of food, beverages, and merchandise at their parks, at resorts and retail stores, as well as the sale of DVDs and things. Do we think that we're going to start visiting something like a Netflix land in the future? Do you think this is just the first step in Netflix becoming a kind of Disney-like conglomerate?
What rides would they have at Netflix land?
Well, the petting zoo would obviously be Tiger King based, I'm sure. Or maybe not. Maybe they want to separate themselves a bit from that.
Maybe a Stranger Things ghost train.
Yeah. Any other ideas?
I've never been into kind of the roller coaster thing, but if like the Queer Eye guys could take me out for shopping and then, you know, remodel my house for free, I'd definitely sign up for that.
An experience store.
Yeah. That's a pretty niche offer thing. Do Netflix own that IP?
Yeah.
Do they? I didn't know that. Anne-Marie, we've spoken before on this podcast about, you have spoken before about how kind of Netflix are really challenging the old guard in Hollywood. Do you think, you know, with this new deal with Spielberg and Amblin, do you think many of the kind of older studios and the ones who've been really tethered to the idea of cinema in the past, do you think it's becoming a case now of kind of jump or be pushed in terms of get on board with the streaming services?
Yeah, I definitely think I've kind of talked about how I would expect to see a further period of consolidation of studios. I think tapping into a streaming service is definitely going to be essential. And I don't necessarily think we like to call it like a streaming war, which in some ways implies that there will be a winner, like there will be one service that we'll always subscribe to and that'll be it. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I would say like most households in the U.S. are probably going to end up having between like 2 and 4 subscriptions based on like their monthly income and then like whether or not they're still paying a cable bill. And so it's not so much it's like a battle of the fittest. It's more like battle of the fit enough. The fit enough will survive. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see probably Amazon, Netflix, and Disney will probably be left standing as the kind of large ones. And then we'll maybe have a couple specialized streaming services. But I really do think that the race right now is kind of less about the streaming and more about just owning the IP, because it's one thing to be funding the new productions, but it's an entirely different thing to be owning the legacy IP that people want to watch on a loop. I mean, like Friends, like the amount of money that Netflix paid for Friends for an additional year, it was like $100 million for 1 year of Friends.
Yeah.
And now it's rolling to HBO because Warner Brothers and HBO used to be both owned by AT&T. And so that I think is really where the race is right now. And that is 100% what Mike Hopkins, who's the senior vice president of Prime Video, said when they acquired MGM. He said the real financial value behind this deal is the treasure trove of IP and the deep catalog that we plan to reimagine and develop together with MGM's talented team. So I think that is where the race is right now on who can get their hands on what.
I think it's a very interesting point, Anne-Marie, because you make there, because there's this thing, I think it's called the economic rule of three, or the economic guideline of three. If you stick it into Wiki, it's there. But basically in every industry, three giants emerge, whether it's the automotive industry or the entertainment industry or like baked beans industry, there will be three brands and everything else ends up being a small boutique player. And you've described exactly what that is, that we're looking at the emergence of three dominant names in the streaming services. Like if you think in your own home country, there's effectively three mobile cell phone providers. There's rarely four. The fourth will generally die. And the same applies in the streaming business. So what that actually implies for, let's say, the smaller streaming businesses is Hulu owned by Disney? I think it is. Hulu's owned by Disney. Yeah. HBO. Who owns HBO? I've kind of lost track.
They're now part of them and Discovery are merging together.
Yeah. So there is definitely a consolidation. And I think we will just see three dominant names emerge, and we have seen three dominant names emerge, and they will survive and grow.
I hope so, because I'm sick of signing up to the streaming services. There's only so many I can keep track of. Let's move on then and talk about another dinosaur, but of a different industry, Ford. So over the last couple of months, something really strange has been happening on Wall Street, which is that Ford stock has actually been going up. Even though it's still a long way off its late 20th century highs, Ford stock has almost trebled in the past year and a bit, buoyed by investor optimism over a reopening economy, plus major commitments made by the company towards its EV future. Indeed, Ford has said that it plans to spend $30 billion on its EV rollout between now and 2025, with a target of having EVs making up over 40% of its production by the end of the decade. It also recently bought an EV startup, Electrify, as well, which I believe is based in charging station software. Interestingly though, and something I want to focus on now, is the launch of their new electric F-150 truck, which has been particularly noteworthy given the fact that that F-150 has been the best-selling truck in the US for the past four decades. And Marie, as our local American here in Stock Club, just how important is the F-150 truck to Ford's future?
I would say it's very important, because the F-150 dominates not only like the retail segment, but it also is huge in the commercial segment in terms of any kind of business that would require a fleet of vehicles.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of something that we're seeing with them opting to electrify the F-150 first. Mm. It is their largest car, but it's also trying to take advantage of both a retail and a commercial market. And that, I think, is something that we're seeing very clearly with the way that the F-150 has been modeled. And I think it benefits Ford on the bottom line, but I think it also will allow them to gradually sell electric vehicles into fleets, because on average, like, customers that will be buying large numbers of vehicles, they turn over 10 to 15% of their fleet every year, but it's not going to be this mass expulsion of vehicles and buying all new ones. And so for that reason, when Ford developed the new F-150, which is called the Lightning, the F-150 Lightning, by the way, they essentially kept the body and the frame of the vehicle and the doors exactly the same. So it means in the manufacturing process, all of that is consistent with its gasoline counterpart. And what that means is that for these commercial customers that have add-ons onto their trucks or have specialty parts or have to place things within the bed for whatever industry they're working in, it means that those items can just be lifted from one truck and placed onto an electric vehicle without skipping a beat. And it is simplified the manufacturing process for Ford, and it has allowed them to keep their price much, much lower. And when you compare the gasoline model of the F-150 to this new one, the only difference is that the electric vehicle actually has more perks. So they are entirely identical, with the exception of a few kind of add-ons, in that, like, now it can go from 0 to 60 in 10 seconds. It has 11 power outlets and apparently can be used as a backup generator for your home for up to 10 days if you were to experience a blackout.
I think that's a very important point, Anne-Marie, as well, though, is that, you know, classically when people have talked about electric cars, electric cars have tended to have been really, really ugly. So when you think of the Toyota Prius, or, you know, even Tesla's Cybertruck, which I think we're going to talk about in a moment, they're not, you know, attractive looking cars, especially if you're particularly interested in cars. And I think it's a massive cultural shift that such an iconic vehicle like the F-150, it still looks the same. It still has the same, I suppose, cultural currency, but it's an electric vehicle. And I think it's kind of selling the idea of this mainstream move to electricity much better to consumers. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I 100% would agree, because I think people tend to set this up as being like, oh, Ford is going after Tesla customers. No, Ford is going after Ford customers.
Yeah.
And just coming to them and saying, here's this truck that you already love. Do you want it to be electric? Because then you can save money down the line. And I think that is brilliant. And I think this kind of initial truck that's being launched is really directed towards commercial customers, because Ford can assume volume of sales and it allows them to keep their prices lower, because they can say, okay, we're going to sell whatever, tens of thousands of these within the first year, which means we can offer its baseline price at $40,000, which is crazy when compared to kind of the price of Teslas. I know Tesla's entry-level vehicle, I think, starts at $35,000, but that's for a small sedan. And if you need to be able to haul 10,000 pounds, that's not going to work for you.
Yeah, interesting. Apart from the cultural side, then, there's also, you know, as someone who's not from the US, I never really understood the fascination with big pickup trucks in the US. But you were saying before we started the podcast that there's actually more of a, I suppose, a practical reason for the preference for pickups in the US rather than a cultural affinity.
Yeah, there's kind of a loophole that people know about. So the Ford F-150 is very popular because a lot of people might be working in fields in which they require towing or they require, you know, a big bed to be carrying lumber or something like that. But actually, interestingly enough, like the second biggest fans of Ford F-150s outside of workmen are the ultra wealthy, actually, in the United States. So for people whose household income is above $200,000 a month, the Ford F-150 is the most popular car in the United States. Like, it's not a Mercedes or a Porsche, it's a Ford F-150. And this is because of the way the U.S. tax law is actually written since about, I think, 2008 is when it was adjusted. And it basically meant if you were a small to medium-sized business or you ran your own business or were self-employed, you can write off a car so long as it's considered a work vehicle for up to $1 million on your taxes fully. You can write off 100% of the cost, but it has to be considered a work vehicle. So for years, it meant that it needed to be a truck or something like a Sprinter van. They have all these kind of technical things that you have to align with. And so it meant these people like orthodontists and, you know, your doctor or your accountant was buying a Ford F-150 because he could write the whole thing off on his taxes and he would get a third of it off. But we kind of ran into a bit of a wall recently because there is an even bigger loophole in the law that states it has to be considered a work truck. And one of the ways you can meet this requirement is if the car weighs more than 6,000 pounds. Well, conveniently enough, the Tesla Model X weighs more than 6,000 pounds because of the massive battery it has. Okay. And so it meant that, again, your dentist could buy a $100,000 car and write the entirety of it off on his taxes.
Wow.
And then on top of that, he gets all these tax exemptions from driving an electric vehicle. So then the government is paying for his car, which is great. So now by Ford putting out a truck that is electric, in theory, it means that all of these wealthy people who own their own businesses and like to buy trucks can now buy an electric vehicle and take advantage of two tax write-offs. So, and the truck is already cheaper than the Model X. So then in theory, you can use your savings to, you know, add the 15-inch touchscreen and the range extender.
Anne-Marie, you are wasted on this podcast. Ford are going to be ringing you up after this, getting you into one of their showrooms. I'm away to buy a Ford. Before we move on from this, Rory, I just wanted to have a quick chat about kind of Ford as an investment. So it's been a long-standing stock in the My Wall Street shortlist, and I don't think anyone could deny Ford's brand value. Is it the case, though, that kind of low-margin businesses like vehicle producers just aren't as popular with modern investors anymore, considering, you know, that there's kind of higher-margin tech and SaaS companies available?
Well, certainly Ford fell out of favor with investors because it was, you know, there was one story in the world of automobiles for the last 10 years, and that was Tesla. And so, you know, the narrative completely changed with a company like Ford. And even now, we're seeing an awful lot of these kind of new businesses SPACing that are trying to get into the space. Nikola, for example, Lordstown Motors, who I've been following enough recently, which is a, you know,
bit of a disaster. Complete,
it's a, not to use the term car crash, but so companies that have been reliably generating automobiles for the last decades are now looking a bit more attractive to investors, especially when you consider Ford's previous history with the F-150, how popular that vehicle was, and the fact that, you know, they're just electrifying it. And, you know, take all those points that Marie just said that I'd never heard of. You really kind of have to love American tax systems. And so, you know, it is definitely, it's been on an absolute run recently. And it's one of those names that, you know, you just never imagine the world not being without.
Yeah. Mm. I think it was Elon Musk said that Tesla and Ford are only two American automakers that have never gone bankrupt. So I suppose we can probably expect Ford to be around for another while.
Yeah. And it also is another, I suppose, anecdote towards the proof that giant brands really don't go bust easily. And the amount of consumer brands I've observed over the years at all-time low share prices, in the trough of disillusionment, and I've bought into the disillusionment thinking, no, it's game over, these guys are dead, only for them to rise again, because these giant brands will be forgiven because of that nostalgia that their brand evokes in the minds of the millions. One of my best friends, Donal, he's a really smart finance guy, and I sometimes go to him for stock advice because it's so utterly naive. And he said to me a couple of months ago, I'm going to buy Ford. And I said, why? And he goes, because it's cheap. And I said, all right, okay, talk to me. Well, tell me, I said, there's cheap and then there's value. I said, is it value or is it cheap? He goes, no, I just like it because it's $5 a share. And I said, yeah, and it's future. He goes, yeah, but it's $5. I said, Donald, please. And I, you know, kind of told him what his job title was, which is suitably impressive. And he goes, yeah, but it's $5 a share. And then he sends me a text the other day like, well, I'm at $15 on Ford. It's getting a bit expensive. It's time to sell. So
you're really hanging Donald out to dry here. Donald, if you're listening, I'm sorry. Let's move on. So the final story I want to touch on here is DraftKings. So DraftKings has been the latest high-flying stock to get hit with a short seller report after the infamous Hindenburg Research announced that it's taking a short position against the stock. In the accompanying report, Hindenburg criticized DraftKings' valuation. It claimed that insiders had dumped more than $1.4 billion worth of stock since the company went public. But worryingly, it also claimed that the company is implicated in black market dealings due to its association with SBTech, which are a Bulgarian-based gaming tech company that formed part of its initial SPAC listing. Rory, we added DraftKings to my Wall Street shortlist earlier this year. Are you worried about a report like this?
So, I mean, I read the report. It's very long. I'm going to break it down into two basic sections. The first is that, you know, the author believes it's overvalued relative to peers and was spending a lot of money on promotions, and that was kind of going to become unsustainable. To be honest, there's nothing really revolutionary there. That to me is the basic bear thesis for this company, and anyone who had looked at the company would have seen that as well, and had to make the call then whether they thought it was a smart investment or not. And he also doesn't really do a very good job in kind of getting his point across. The second part relates to that, to the culmination of what were three entities, which essentially resulted in DraftKings becoming a publicly traded company last year. Now, it's a long report. It's a little difficult to follow. I'm going to do my best to summarize it here. If people are really interested, they can go and read it themselves. But essentially, three entities, the SPAC sponsors, DraftKings, and the Bulgarian tech firm you mentioned, SBTech, essentially came together to become what is now DraftKings, the publicly traded company. SBTech was essentially a white label solution for online sports books. So plenty of businesses basically just plugged their technology into the back end and ended up handling all the payments. When this newly public listed company came, DraftKings essentially acquired that business, which had some revenue coming in. I think at the time it was about 20% of the overall revenue. Now as DraftKings has grown rapidly, that's now only about 10% of their overall revenue. But what Hindenburg claims is that years back, we're talking 7 or 8 years ago, SBTech was selling its solution into companies that were operating in markets where online gambling was illegal, places like Vietnam and Thailand. And, you know, they offer various points of proof. I'm going to put in bunny ears now because I don't believe it actually is. It's very substantiated, but things like unnamed former staff members were saying that this was happening. Around 2017, one of the key employees in SBTech left the company to start another business, which was called BTI and was later renamed CoreTech. And Hindenburg is claiming that CoreTech is essentially a front for SBT's operations in countries where gambling is illegal. Now, this is where I kind of get lost with it, because, you know, of all the things, I don't know much about corporate governance laws in Bulgaria. And it has to be said that some of the evidence in the report that they claim as proof is pretty weak. There's a screenshot from a website that lists CoreTech as one of its tech partners and also says that it's in the Mandarin language option. So that's the report suggests that's proof that it's illegally operating in China, even though hundreds of millions of people outside China speak Mandarin. Yeah. There's a photo of a holiday hamper that was sent to CoreTech from a company whose branding was connected with an online betting network in Vietnam. That to me is not hard proof of fraud. And maybe I'm being a bit hard on the writer here and probably picking out and choosing some of the more outrageous examples, but some of it was pretty laughable, I have to say.
Yeah.
Then again, we don't know what kind of legal issues could arise here. I'm not a lawyer. I haven't read every US state's gambling and license laws. DraftKings have come out and denied the allegations. They've said they looked at the company at acquisition and saw no real issues. And I really don't think DraftKings was buying this company for its revenue anyway when they acquired SB Tech. I think they wanted to own their own technology for their sports book. And this was just a way to expedite that and get them to the market faster than their rivals. So, you know, people can read the report themselves. It seems to be a little bit, you know, I think there's a bit of a mountain out of a molehill being made here.
Yeah.
And if there is issues, it's something that's just going to have to be addressed within the business. They might have to, you know, cut some ties to other subsidiaries or entities that SB Tech was involved in.
Yeah.
But look, we'll wait and see. Hindenburg Research has been proven to find some things in the past. Recently, they were on top of Nikola. They mentioned Lordstown Motors before that whole thing came out. So Nate Anderson does do his homework, and we'll have to just wait and see. I really don't think it's a big issue, but he seems to have looked at it more than I have.
Okay, interesting. You'll have to brush up on your Bulgarian tax laws before the next episode, Rory.
That's my weekend sorted.
So let's move on then. We have a few very exciting things going on in My Wall Street at the moment. By the time this episode goes live, Emmett, you'll have already held your latest master investing workshop called Three Stocks That Will Define the Next Decade. I believe you pitch a brand new acronym in this workshop that will replace FANG and FATMAN for the next decade. Can you give me a 30-second pitch on this new acronym?
Yeah, well, so FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google, and FATMAN, which is Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Tesla, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Netflix, were posthumously created after those seven businesses went through mega growth. And what I'm going to try and do is predict an acronym that will be around in 10 years from now, made up of eight companies that I believe all have the attributes to grow in a manner similar to each of the FATMAN stocks or FATMAN stocks.
Interesting. What is the acronym? Get people jazzed up so you can guess what it is.
Altitude.
Altitude. Okay. Okay. A-L-T-I-T-U-D-E. Send in your answers on a postcard if you think you know what it is. But if you tune into the workshop, which you'll have missed it by the time you're listening to this, but you'll be able to catch the replay in the link for the notes today's show. Send in answers on a postcard what you think the rest of those stocks might be.
Acme Bricks is the first one.
Of course, along with this Master Investing Workshop, the joining window for our Premium Horizon services opened up too. This only opens up four times a year and will close before the 1st of July. So now's your chance to join this service that, at the moment, is more than doubling the average returns of the S&P 500. There are a limited number of discounted early bird spots available in the workshop that might still be available when you're listening to this. However, if they're gone, I've included a discount link exclusive for Stock Club listeners that will get you $50 off your first year's membership of Horizon. You can find all of these links in the notes for today's show, as I mentioned, or by going to the Stock Club homepage. So you can just Google Stock Club My Wall Street and it should come up first in the results. But make sure you're quick about it. As I said, the window is closing by July 1st. So Rory, usually when we have an interview on Stock Club, I say we've got a special treat coming up and you kind of make fun of me. So what we have coming up now is an exciting what's a synonym for treat?
Present? I don't know.
Maybe not an exciting present. We have an interview coming up instead of Jargon Busters this week. And this is an interview that Emmett held last week with Masterworks CEO Scott Lynn. Masterworks is a platform that effectively lets you buy and sell shares in iconic pieces of art, featuring pieces from artists as diverse as Banksy and Andy Warhol. Masterworks is a fascinating way for you to potentially diversify your investments into art without actually having to shell out millions of dollars to buy an entire piece. Emmett, I'm a bit of a philistine when it comes to art, but I found the conversation you and Scott had very interesting. Have you ever considered art or investing in art before?
Well, I have bought art. I never regarded it as an investment because my wife and I have just bought pieces we like the look of. And I'm sure one or two of them might turn out to be worth something, hopefully, while we paid in a few years from now. But until I met Masterworks, I didn't really consider it. And I have looked very closely and I've walked through their onboarding experience, which I very much liked. And I am a fan of some of the pieces they have on their platform. So in all likelihood, I am going to invest in a Masterwork of some nature in the next few months.
Interesting. Well, here comes the interview with Scott. It's a really interesting interview. He talks about, you know, the actual mechanics of investing in a piece of art. And he even mentions things like NFTs, which we talked about recently in the show. And it's safe to say he's not so hot on them. So enjoy the interview and make sure to stick around until the end, because we've a pretty good elevator pitch coming at the end of today's show.
Scott, welcome to Stock Club. Delighted to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, before we talk about investing in art, could you talk to me about the art market as a whole?
Sure. Yeah, so most people don't really understand the size and the scope of the art market. But very generally, we tell people to think of this as a $1.7 trillion asset class. And comparatively, you can think of that versus like private equity or venture, which is roughly $3.5 trillion. So roughly half the size of venture private equity. And then each year, roughly $60 billion in art sells. So a couple percent turnover every year. So it's a very large asset class. I think the reason most people don't know a lot about it is because historically, it's really been limited to the ultra wealthy. A lot of these paintings cost millions of dollars to buy, cost tens of millions of dollars to build a portfolio. So most people just aren't familiar with the asset class because of that reason.
Yeah, just like the stock market maybe 30 years ago was to preserve of the fortunate and the wealthy. Here at My Wall Street, we have a set of parameters that we use to assess individual stocks. What parameters can somebody apply to art?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So when I started Masterworks, I guess 3.5 years ago, that was one of the key questions, was how do we build a research team to understand which segments of the art market are performing the best? How do we think about correlation between art and other asset classes? How do we think about volatility? How do we think about loss rates? And, you know, the basis of that research really in the art market is public data. So out of these $60 billion a year that trades in the art market, roughly half of that is a public auction. So surprisingly, I think to most people, you actually have this very large data set within the art market you can analyze to understand how do you think about returns, how do you think about a lot of those other characteristics that I mentioned. So just like any asset class, you know, we start with data and we analyze different segments to try to conclude what is most investable.
So Scott, I went through the onboarding experience of Masterworks. It was absolutely brilliant. I ended up speaking to one of your specialists, and I felt really reassured that you have mastered the funnel of finding great pieces of art. And I noticed that there was something like nearly 7,000, you know, artist markets analyzed, resulting in 55 artists, and then ultimately 17 pieces of art made the grade onto your platform. So could you tell me how many individual paintings or shares in paintings should an individual investor aspire to have?
Well, it's a great question. And the question really is related to diversification and how we think about diversification within the asset class. So today, when an investor comes to Masterworks.io, they're really looking at individual paintings to pick and choose which painting to invest in. You know, as of now, we don't offer a diversified fund-like product. So we get this question a lot, and you know, we don't have an exact answer. I guess I would say there's two things for investors to think about. One is that up until Masterworks, there's never been a way to do portfolio construction with art as an asset class, because if you want to construct a portfolio, you're really required to go out and buy whole paintings. So Basquiat might cost $20 million, and Jonas Wood might cost $1 million. There's no good way to do portfolio construction. So the cool thing that you can do with Masterworks is you can invest the exact same amount of money in every single painting and create an equally weighted portfolio. The second thing I would say is that we have done some work to try to understand how many paintings does it take to achieve a good risk-adjusted return with lower volatility and more predictive returns. And we think that number is somewhere between six and eight paintings over time. And that's very, very limited research on pre-existing portfolios that investors have. So it's not, you know, it's not a huge amount, but it's certainly not two or three paintings either. And part of, you know, I think part of that number, the reason 6 to 8 is lower than what you typically think of, is because most of the artists that we focus on are very blue chip in nature anyway. So the volatility in their markets is lower than most. But yeah, those are the two things I would think about when it comes to diversification.
Are there many cases of famous art pieces depreciating in value? And if so, like what caused it?
Yeah, it's another great question. One of the things we'd like to talk a lot about is we're sort of the top 100 artist markets and how those top 100 artist markets performed over time. So it's very interesting. If you look at the top 100 artists, and these are people like Basquiat, Picasso, Monet, et cetera, there's only been three artists that we've seen that have actually depreciated, I believe, over the last 25 years. And that is Damien Hirst, Jeff Koons, and Murakami. And I think with all three of those, you know, you can pretty safely say that those artists have tried to manipulate their market in ways that it just hasn't been well received, you know, without going into detail on that. So, you know, living artists sometimes are tricky in that you can have artists, you know, in the example of Damien Hirst, I think the thing that really changed this market is he decided at one point that he wanted to sell directly to collectors. There was an auction where he tried to do that, and it really upset his dealers that had supported him for a long time and major collectors that collected him, because he decided to really go directly to new collectors and sell work directly. So, you know, there are risks like that with living artist markets, but generally once an artist reaches that top 100, you know, benchmark, they pretty consistently produce positive return.
Yeah, the parallels between art and stock investing really are unmissable. Diversify, take a long-term mentality. In the world of stocks, we say never borrow to buy, which I'm sure is the exact same for the world of art.
Yeah.
But there's two things I'm not especially clear on. What's the exit mechanism? And how is a painting accurately valued?
Yeah. So let me take those in reverse order. So a painting is valued just like real estate. So remember that I mentioned that half of the art market is traded at public auction. And in the US, Western Europe, UK, and other territories, there's actually kind of fair transparency reporting laws that require auction houses to publicly report transparent prices on transactions that happen within those houses. So we have this huge database of effectively comparables for every work that we look at. So if we're, you know, if we're marketing a 1982 Basquiat to our investors, we'll show them how have similar 1982 Basquiats performed in the past, or how much have they sold for in the past, so the investor can get a sense for appreciation rate for similar paintings over time. And many of these artists have huge markets, right? Like Monet, for example, in any given year will sell $200 to $400 million. And $200 to $400 million doesn't sound like a lot, but if you assume that 3% of his material sells in any given year, then you kind of get a $6 billion plus market cap for that artist and the total value of his art. So to answer your second point, really the way to value art is through public comparables, just like real estate. The first point around liquidity is interesting. So, you know, when we started the business, we told investors to think of these as 3 to 10 year illiquid holds. And the difference between investing in art versus investing in a public equity is that liquidity is far less, right? You have to wait for a long time to ultimately sell that position. Whereas with an exchange traded security, you can get out of it right away. Last year, we did introduce trading markets on Masterworks. So we do have investors trading shares in paintings now, just like you trade shares in a public equity. Now, the difference is still, you know, these are not exchange traded securities. So you can't exit a security in milliseconds, right? Like if you make an offer or if you post an offer to sell something, that trade can take a couple of days or maybe even a week to clear. But it is definitely much better than waiting 10 years like you historically had to do in the art market.
So Scott, tell us more about Masterworks. How was the business born? When did the idea come to you, and what's your vision for the business?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so the idea came from just 15 plus years of starting technology companies and also collecting art. So I think, you know, personally, I have a top 100 collection in the U.S. focused really on abstract expressionism. So those are people like Pollock, Klein, de Kooning, Rothko, Frankenthaler, some names that some of the listeners may be familiar with. And, you know, I think as I was collecting art throughout the years, I just saw it appreciate in value and started to dive in and try to understand at a lower level, you know, how to think about returns in the art market. And I think, you know, one of the things that the Masterworks talks a lot about is how does art as an asset class compare to every other asset class, both from a return perspective as well as a correlation perspective. And I think what you find very quickly is if you look at contemporary art as defined as art created after World War II, that segment of the market has outperformed the S&P for the past 25 years. It's appreciated at 14% a year from 1995 through 2021. So that's a very interesting asset class. Now, the challenge with the asset class, at least historically, was there was no way to invest in it, right? Masterworks is still the only company today that offers investment products in art. So the only way to invest in it was to go out and actually buy a whole painting and then eventually sell that painting to another collector down the road. So our view or our vision for the business is, how do we build out investment products for the asset class so that every investor can allocate some percentage of a portfolio to art?
So what's the minimum amount of money required for an entry level retail art investor? What would you recommend kind of having as your, I suppose, entry level target allocation?
Yeah, so we've done different asset allocation models within Masterworks. And, you know, the challenge with asset allocation models is many investors that come to our website, I would say, you know, the majority of investors out of the 170,000 that have signed up at Masterworks tend to be kind of double-digit type return investors, right? So they're seeking 10-plus percentage returns. And when we take that objective and we look at other asset classes like public equities, fixed income in today's world, which obviously is not that exciting, and so on, you can wind up with a very large allocation of art simply because it's outperformed other asset classes. I think if you step away from that and just take a more pragmatic perspective and say, hey, what percentage of my portfolio am I comfortable having allocated to an illiquid alternative? Most people come down with somewhere between 1.5% and 8% of the portfolio. And that's some research that we've done with Citi as well historically. So, you know, that's usually the range that I give people, but it's very investor specific.
So basically I can own a fraction of a multi-million dollar painting for like $10,000.
Yeah. And we even, you know, depending on the investor and the size of their portfolio, if they come to the Masterworks website and they sign up, our membership team will even lower that minimum.
Yes.
If it's too high, depending on their portfolio.
So I can literally buy. So if I went and bought a stake in the Basquiat that you have, or a Monet, or the Banksy I saw on your website, which I think has since been fully sold, where do I go to see the pictures?
Well, it's a great question. So we have all of the art shipped today to Fine Art Storage in Delaware, and that's really a sales and use tax kind of avoidance process. So we don't have to pay sales or use tax. It's shipped to Delaware and stays in Delaware. You know, we do have a gallery in Soho, but to be honest, the business has grown so quickly over the past couple of years of 170,000 investors on the platform now. We're not really focused on bringing people into the gallery, and COVID has kind of disrupted that process as well. So I think going forward, it's more of a priority to take individual artworks and lend them to institutions or museums, and then let our members know when they go there. Like we have a Banksy right now at MoCA in Amsterdam. I think we have a couple of other artworks in other institutions. But I think that's really our longer term goal.
Nice. Okay, well, we usually finish Stock Club with an elevator pitch. So in keeping with the tradition, can you pitch a painting that you think people should invest in now, and why?
Well, so I can't pitch a current offering again because of regulatory reasons, but I can I'll give you an example of a prior artist market and some of the things we've seen over the past year. So one of the artists who most people are familiar with that our research team identified as interesting a couple of years ago was Banksy. And at the time, Banksy's market was only accelerating. I think we had it measured at 13 or 14% a year in terms of appreciation rate. Post-COVID, we've just seen a huge explosion of interest in Banksy, primarily from non-art world people, right? So Banksy is an anonymous artist. He doesn't have a gallery that represents him. He's really lived outside of the traditional art world infrastructure. And he's always, from our perspective, he's had cultural significance, but he's always been a little bit on the edge of, I guess, how we think about an acceptable artist for our investors. But we've really seen the pop culture nature of his market take off during COVID, accelerate rapidly, I think significantly because of the crypto community. Like we've seen the crypto community with NFTs and such come into the art market a little bit, and his prices are now up, 100% over the past year. So he's an artist that we found very early on, identified some momentum with, and whose market has absolutely exploded.
So one last question, Scott, before you go, because you touched on it. NFTs, buy, sell, or hold?
Sell.
I mean, you're a seller of NFTs, not a fan.
Yeah, we don't look. I mean, we do not view NFTs as investments. You know, we think they're certainly interesting from a digital art perspective. It's interesting that artists are creating them, but since you don't actually acquire any copyright or intellectual property with an NFT, I think we struggle with what people are really buying and whether that's a good long-term investment.
So there's no chance of me getting my first tweet onto Masterworks, no?
Yeah.
Okay, Scott, thank you very much for joining us today and best of luck with Masterworks.
Thanks, Emmett.
That was a treat, James. Thank you for that.
Knew you'd like it.
Thanks again to Scott for joining us on the Stock Club. And if you want to learn more about Masterworks, make sure to check them out at masterworks.io. Okay, let's finish up today with an elevator pitch. So for our last episode of 2020, I asked Emmett and Rory to give me their big pitches for the coming year. Seeing as how we're about halfway through 2021 now, I want to check in on these predictions and see how they're going. Rory, I'm going to come to you first. So in December 2020, you predicted that Spotify's stock would increase by 50% in the coming year. Currently, they're...
Did I?
Yeah, you did. It's on record. Currently, they're down about...
I really have to stop drinking for the end of your podcast.
Currently, they're down about 20% year to date. So are you still confident in your prediction?
Based on how the market has behaved in the first part of the year, I suppose maybe 50% was probably a bit ambitious.
Yeah.
We did have that big kind of tech sector rotation at the start of the year. In terms of the business, though, I like everything that I'm seeing from them. They're making what I think is all the big moves in the podcast space at the moment. Apple had their big announcement that they were going to start doing subscription podcasts, and Spotify completely undercut them and are really heavily investing now in the user experience with a number of acquisitions. We even had one just a couple of days ago, a company called Pods that helps people discover new podcasts.
Yeah.
I think Spotify has a long way to go. I don't think this is something that's going to be sorted out in the next year or two. Apple is making the bet that content creators will pay up to access what's their audience was, whereas Spotify is certainly going down the route of trying to attract an audience with things like exclusives and better UI. And I think Apple probably know that their main revenue is going to be from the App Store in general. And that, you know, this is something that I think Spotify can kind of own. It'll be interesting to see what the long-term implications of Apple's kind of very anti-Spotify moves are, considering the EU's been looking at the cases very closely. But I still love Spotify as an investment. I don't know whether they're going to hit the 50% this year, but that's why you don't make short-term predictions, I suppose. That's why that's why you don't listen to mine.
Anne-Marie, you and Mike are going to be asked to do it this year, so I hope you're taking notes. Emmett, you made a bold prediction that Macy's stock would double this year. It's currently up 60% year to date, so you must be feeling pretty good about your chances.
Actually, correction, James, I can ring the bell because on the day we recorded that podcast, Macy's was $10.28. And on the 15th of March, it was $20.76. So It doubled in the year. Now it's currently up. It's now at like $18.61. So I think I can claim a prize at least for that particular call.
No, it is that on the same day in December, it has to have doubled exactly that day,
really?
Or else you're wrong. no, pretty.
Okay, that
was
I
a
like
pretty
that.
Pretty good call. You were on a pretty hot streak there at the start of the year, Emmett. You got Macy's, you got AMC. What else?
Wasn't your prediction the year before that Macy's would go bankrupt or that something would go
Yeah,
bankrupt?
It was. No one
You're
first,
really
but I did.
Just playing yourself off your own predictions.
I did acknowledge that when I made the pitch. I did say, look, I know I said, I said there'd be a death of a lot of retail brands. I call out Macy's specifically? I can't remember.
You did say the year before you said it would be the year of Oculus Rift. So we always have that one to fall back on.
It was. It was good. It was a good year for Oculus. But so do I think Macy's will be up 100% by this coming December? Yeah, I do actually. Yeah, I think so. They were in the peak of the coronavirus storm, I guess, when I had that call, and they were capitalized for the year ahead. And I think footfall is increasing in all their stores, and they showed underperforming shops over in America. So I think they'll be up double from when I said it, but they're nearly there now anyway.
Okay, there's no in altitude. There's no M for Macy's, so
no.
You just have to
there's
go
no
out
bricks and
Macy's
mortar at all. Actually, there's no bricks and mortar. Although there is real physical.
So that's
product.
It from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in My Wall Street at the moment. And don't forget about the replay of Emmett's workshop and the special discount to Horizon for Stock Club listeners. The links of these are all in the notes for today's show, as I said, or simply Google Stock Club My Wall Street to find our podcast homepage, and you can check them all out there. Remember, it's a limited window until the end of the month, so don't hang about. If there's anything else you want to discuss or explain on the next episode of Stock Club, make sure to get in touch. You can find us on Twitter, that's at MyWallStreetHQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club, and if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a rating for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. That's it from the three of us here today, four of us here today. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.